Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Catherine Boo, whose book is titled Behind the Beautiful Forevers, Life, Death, and Hope in a Mumbai Undercity. Catherine Boo is a staff writer for New Yorker. She has written for the Washington City Paper, Washington Monthly, Washington Post, won the Pulitzer Prize in 2000 for a piece on group homes for mentally disabled. She joined the New Yorker in 2003. Behind the Beautiful Forevers is the story of life in a slum right near the airport in Mumbai. Catherine Boo spent 4 years working on this particular book from March 2007 to March 2011. So let's go back to the beginning a little bit and talk a little bit about how you came to meet these people, mm-hmm. who they were, and how they kind of filtered into your book. So you have been interested in people without money, disabled people, those experiences. Is there a reason for that specifically? What draws you to something like Mumbai?
When I met my husband in 2001, I'd been working in low-income communities all over the United States. I started in Washington, and then I worked in housing projects in Oklahoma City, in communities like Cut Off, Louisiana, in border towns between Texas and Mexico. And I would be working very intensely in those communities. Then I would come home with Sunil, who was born in Delhi, and we'd be whisking off to India, where so much of his intellectual life and his family were. And so when I was in a place like Mumbai, obviously India is the second fastest growing economy in the world. Mumbai is the financial and film capital, but at the same time, 60% of citizens live in slums. And that number wasn't shrinking. The percentage of citizens living in slums was expanding. And so I couldn't just turn off my brain and stop asking the same questions I ask in my own country. I'm not interested in depicting people living lives in squalor. I'm not interested in the physical contours of poverty so much as I am in how do people get out of poverty in this society? What's the infrastructure of opportunity here for these people? What are the economic and social springboards? My own life has been an instruction on the things in this world that we can't control. One example would be that I got quite ill when I was a teenager and have been trying throughout my career to balance issues of illness and disability with the kinds of work that I want to do. So at some level, I've always been interested in the ways in which luck and fortune can change people's lives and have had a sense that it's not only what you do and how well you do it that makes you successful or not, that there are a lot of outlying factors. I probably need many, 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 many hundreds of hours in therapy to figure out, like, what is at the root of why I do what I do. But that's part of it. But the other part of it is that I think that I have felt from an early age that the ways in which people have written about low-income communities and low-income people tends to be sentimental or sensationalistic. It tends to be one-dimensional. And I did feel that there was room in journalism not just to describe people in their complexity and their thinking and their imaginations, but also to use investigative techniques that I've learned over the years to look at how on-the-books opportunities for such people really get experienced on the ground.
One phrase that you actually made in an interview was that you find these issues to generally be over-theorized and under-reported.
We're living in a time where there's a lot of ideological point scoring and nuts and bolts reporting may fall by the wayside. And I think that there is, particularly with the foreign journalist, is the foreign journalist may hire a fixer, for instance, and the fixer will go to a community and say, okay, so let's find the person who represents this quality. Let's find the cute kid with a good story. And then the foreign journalist comes in and interviews the pre-selected people or works under the auspices of an NGO. For instance, and then the NGO will pick their success stories. And I think that that gives you a distorted idea of the way poverty and opportunity are actually experienced in India, in my own country. Because most people are not sitting there waiting for rescuers and do-gooders. And in many cases, their impression of the people that we understand to be do-gooders is more complex than you might think. So I try to go into a community totally unaffiliated without any other allegiances and try to find out what the issues are that matter to them and who they are, and follow them over a long period of time, because I don't think that these still snapshots, they don't really capture the signature quality of a global market time, which is that it's volatile. It's you move up, you slip back down, you move up again. That's the nature of work and life now. And so that's why I spend ridiculous amounts of time in certain communities.
It seems that what you're saying, and I don't want you to go too much into it further because there's so many areas to cover, is that most reporters in going into a situation like this have a pre-established storyline in their heads, and they're trying to bring that storyline or something similar to it to either print or whatever media rather than walking in and seeing what the storylines actually might be.
Well, I will say that there are many, many good reporters who don't do that. But I think that often when I'm reading a story, I'm wondering about, okay, what are the agreements that have been made beforehand that may affect the way that we're seeing this?
You made a choice here, and you've made the choice throughout to do something that, insofar as I know, the first person to do it, though that maybe you know people before that, would have been Truman Capote in Cold Blood, possibly Lillian Ross in the picture, which is to tell a documentary story and completely remove the reporter so that you don't exist in the context of the story. What were your own antecedents? Were those two important to you?
Well, I mean, Truman Capote took immense factual liberties with what he did, and so I don't consider him a nonfiction writer. One person who does this beautifully is Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc, who there are moments in her book that she's in it, but mainly she's focusing on the people that she's writing about in her amazing book, Random Family, which is rightly recognized as a classic now. But my feeling is that the subjects that I care about most aren't subjects that people are desperate to read about in general. So I realize that I have a limited amount of space and time that a reader is going to give me for these subjects, and I want every single sentence that I'm writing to bring you closer to people like a 13-year-old scavenger boy, like Sunil, who gathers trash at the airport. What I feel about Sunil, what I experienced as I reported, you know, probably in my own mind, there's sort of a separate book about that. And in fact, my brilliant, courageous translator, Unnati Tripathi, she and her boyfriend, over the course of the reporting, started making an imaginary graphic novel about how absurd we were doing the reporting. So, you know, I could have written something like that, but I want the words on the page to bring the reader into the world of the people, as you know, and into their minds as much as possible, because there are a lot of books where you can learn about the writer and the process. And as a reader, I like my high modernism. I like the author in the foreground. But for my own work, I want to keep myself out of view as much as possible.
The choice of the Anawadi slum located, it sounds like it's almost in a ditch, because you talk about a toxic lake right in the midst of
yeah.
the slum. It's kind of just next to the airport road, across the street from the airport. Is that about right?
It's across the street from the entry to the international terminal, and is surrounded by 5 luxury hotels now. There's a Hyatt, there's a Sheraton, there's something called, at the time, it was called Intercontinental the Grand. Anawadi and some adjacent settlements are there in low-lying ground, surrounded by these towers. And this kid, Murchie Hussein, who's a young, smart, cool kid in the slum, summed up the setting better than I ever could when he said to his brother one day, "Everything around us is roses and we're the in between." And my private title for this book was The in Between. It didn't really go over with the publishers, but it captures a setting, but it also captures an awareness of inequality and the way that they see themselves with more economy than I could possibly have done.
I was very struck by the way these characters emerge. They emerge as if in a novel. I was astonished to read in the epilogue that just to understand what happened to the character, the person, Fatima, a woman who died in a fire, set herself on fire, you spoke to 168 different people
right.
and gathered reports.
Right. I gathered official records from the police department, the public hospital, the morgue, the courts. So I gathered a wealth of information. In the book, if you read the beginning of the book, and for instance, I talk about what the smell of a woman setting herself on fire was like at a certain point at night. And that is from many different people, but it's also from an official police record. So the reader doesn't necessarily have to know the documentary work that's gone into something like that. But I think that when you have that level of reporting or that level of documentary work, you can write something with a bit more conviction than you might ordinarily have had. There's a point in the book where I talk about deaths, the deaths of some young and amazing people, and the way that those deaths were construed officially and what actually happened to them. I write about 3 deaths, but over time, I'd been working, sort of following almost every death that happened in the slum and trying to figure out, and in other slums as well, and trying to figure out whether what I was seeing was an isolated, immense devaluation of life and failure to investigate the deaths of young people, or whether that was something that was really significant in that community. And it was. And so I don't need to write about all of those deaths, but if I can make you understand what happened in a few, then maybe you can understand not just the law, individual losses of life, but the systemic problems.
So, for instance, did you know Sanjay, for instance? Had you met him prior to he killed himself?
Yeah.
Had you met him prior to that?
Yeah. He was just one of the boys. There were many boys on the road. They were thieves. Mainly their work was to climb the concertina wire at the increasingly beautiful, magnificently landscaped Mumbai airport, and to climb over the concertina wire and rob the recycling bins. If you've been on a plane, I urge you, when you pass the galley where the air hosts and hostesses work, you will see these metal boxes, these square metal boxes with latches, and they keep cups and things in them. When the seals on those break, the airlines get rid of them, and they throw them in a recycling bin in Mumbai and here. And to the people of Anawadi, those were precious. You could get 30 rupees selling those boxes to recyclers. But you had to climb concertina wire, and you had to accept that your skin would be, you know, you'd just be wounded going over the fence. And so Sanjay was one of those boys who made his living by climbing over and stealing at the airport. The stewardess's gallery, to me, is just this immense wealth to the people of Anawadi.
And Fatima, you knew as well before she died, too.
Fatima, it's funny because I have some trouble walking some days more than others. My first experience of her was I was spending time with Abdul, who's a young garbage sorter, supporting his family of 11. And the first time that I was even aware that in the next hut was a disabled woman was when people started pushing her wheelchair at me. It was a joke. They were like, oh, you need this. It was two rusted bicycle wheels and a cracked plastic lawn chair that somebody had made for her. And most of the time she used crutches. So that was how I became aware of her existence. And then I also almost immediately knew her children. And I knew as well that Fatima wasn't properly taking care of her children. And so my first reaction to her was one of judgment, because her daughters are amazing and they're just full of life. And she wasn't paying much attention to them. She was taking lovers. But only later it was just interesting because I, having these disabilities and troubles myself, that I was so quick to judge her before I really started to think about what her life was like. And she was the woman, nobody even called her by her name. They called her the one leg. She was a joke. And sometimes she would put on lipstick, and people would find that so hilarious. What is this disabled woman doing, putting on lipstick? She thinks people will find her attractive. But she wanted to be treated like a human being, and she wanted respect. So she had so much anger, beginning from her parents who had hidden her in the hut ashamed, that she was determined that her existence be recognized by other people. And it took me a long time to be sympathetic to that. But her own life as a person and her own physical struggles in a place where even for the strongest people, just getting by and just running a household and pumping water, surviving in monsoons, in a place where a sewage lake supports malaria and dengue fever, it's just filled with mosquitoes and there's tuberculosis, and just getting by day to day in the slum is so difficult that I really judged myself. I said, you know, I didn't really fully, because like many people, I saw her beat her children. I didn't really consider what the circumstances of her life was.
Two questions. One, going back, the choice of Anawadi. There are many, many slums like Anawadi.
Right.
Was there a specific reason that you zeroed in on that particular slum, or was it that you began going there and got to know the people?
In the beginning, I was reporting hard in a bunch of different slums. And if anybody knows Mumbai, I was in a place called Turbe Store. I was in a transit camp for people who had been, their slums had been demolished and they were waiting for rehabilitation. That was not coming very quickly. And many other slums. But I came to Anawadi in 2007 and met a woman named Asha. And Asha had been born in true poverty in Vidarbha, which is a rural region that many people know of because it's become international shorthand for the difficulty of rural Indian poverty. There are many, many farmer suicides there. And Asha had been born there into a family where when food was short, the girls went hungry. because they were not as important as laborers. And when I went home to meet her family, some of her relatives, older relatives, walked on all fours. They were so bent by agricultural labor that they couldn't stand straight. So that was Asha's background. She was married early on to a man who drank more than he worked. So he wasn't supporting the family, and she had three children who she adored. And when I met Asha, and then I met her teenage daughter, Manju, who was sensitive and beautiful and compassionate.
And bright.
And very bright, and was poised to become Anahuasi's first female college graduate. I wanted to know how a woman like Asha had produced this daughter, Manju. And one of the things that Asha said about Manju is she thought that it was a failure of her parenting, that Manju was sentimental and that Manju cared for some of the poorer girls in the slum and was trying to teach them English, which she knew a little bit. She was still struggling to learn. But she felt that Manju's quality of being compassionate was actually going to hurt her in her future. You know, so she just wished that Manju would be a little less virtuous. And Manju herself prided herself on her virtue because she felt that her mother, it was her teenage rebellion, because she felt that her mother had done things to give her a chance that were not virtuous.
In the end, what you did is you focused basically on two families plus Sunil, the scavenger, the Hussein family, mm-hmm. the son Abdul, who, if anybody is the protagonist running through the book, it's
right.
Abdul,
right.
His mother, Zerenisa, his father, Karam, and his sister, Kekishan, as well as Asha and her daughter, Manju, and son Rahan. These are the people you focused on. It's obvious why you focused on Asha. Did you wind up focusing on Abdul and his family because of the events?
No. I first became fascinated with Abdul 7 months before he was falsely accused of setting fire to Fatima, the woman everyone called the one leg. And I was interested in him when Sunil, the young scavenger, first described Abdul to me. I said, "What is he like to you?" He said, "He keeps his head down night and day." And Abdul was physically bent over a pile of rich people's garbage night and day, supporting his family of 11, because garbage work and tuberculosis had destroyed his father's lungs, and so his father wasn't able to work, and he'd been doing this work since childhood. His mother would haggle for goods. She's illiterate, but she was witty and good with words and able to negotiate prices very well. Abdul had spent so little time in his life doing anything besides work that he was almost embarrassed at the sound of his own voice. He felt that he wasn't intelligent. He felt that he didn't know anything of the world because he'd just been staring at garbage day and night. And so he was a silent kid, silent, awkward kid, bent in this open space in the slum, sorting through, making a living on empty luggage tags, water bottles, newspapers, scrap metal. He was somebody I just wanted to know. I thought that he was a remarkable story. And often, it took many months before I realized the quality of his mind and the way that he was thinking about the world.
You recount in an interview that came with the book, you recount that every so often he would speak, and you would realize that there was almost a philosopher in there, inside of him.
Abdul didn't have enough time to develop proper human relationships. He had one semi-friend, one half-friend, Kalu, who was a garbage thief, a delightful young man. But when you're working day and night from that age, you just don't get to develop those emotional attachments that boys with more leisure had. Even his own brothers had more leisure. And he didn't really have anybody to talk to. He was a kid without honor in his own family because he was just the workhorse. He was the drudge. And the younger kids, they were witty. They were charming. And so he would compare himself to his younger brother, Murchie, and find himself immensely wanting.
One thing that struck me, and you mention it in the afterword, that every so often kids would, you taught the kids how to use the recorder when you weren't around. Would that
right.
have been Abdul and Sunil?
No. Well, Sunil did. There were certain, like, the first chapter of the book opens with one of the kids in the slum, Rahul, has managed to break the invisible barrier between the slum world and the rich world. He's gotten some temp jobs bussing dirty plates at a Bollywood party. The first time I started realizing that the children all around me could be video documenting their own lives was one of the days that he went to the party, and there was a steep hill of garbage and cutting past a sewer to get from Anahuasi to the Intercontinental Hotel. And I couldn't get up it fast enough. And it was this great excitement of the kids following Rahul to this job. And so I just gave somebody a camera and said, "You climb up the hill." And what was so extraordinary was that when I finally got there, they didn't cross the street to the Intercontinental Hotel, but they were following with the camera Rahul going into it. And then they were doing tracking shots, and they were doing close-ups, and they, you know, so they had figured out in about 5 minutes, the five-minute journey, how to be far better with the video camera than I did.
Did you always feel safe? You've said that you felt safer with the people in the slum than you ever did going into the police station, that's
right.
For sure.
Right. I had a bad experience, particularly one night with the police. The police were not too keen on me doing this project, and they made it, particularly when I started investigating deaths, which reflected on their work. So they made it quite tough for me at the time. But I mainly felt safe in Anawadi. I mean, sometimes there were moments of violence, mostly involving people who were very, very drunk and angry. That happened. But in low-income American communities, there are an awful lot more guns than there are in a place like Anawadi, and most fights are with fists or with knives. Most violence is like that. And so compared to other communities that I was in, it was a much safer place to be, even late at night.
There are commonalities, as you've said, with other poor communities. When thinking back on this, there's a tendency to see the trees, the individuals, rather than the forest mm-hmm. as a whole. Mm-hmm. But you sometimes have to look at that forest. What myths have been propagated about life in a slum like that that turn out to be so false that going there will change your perspective?
Well, I think that there are a lot of myths about poor communities in any culture, and one of them is the idea of people as essentially being simple-minded and passive. In a place like Mumbai, if you're passive, you starve. In a world where there are fewer and fewer social safety nets, you know, people are simply not able to be passive. They're having to reinvent themselves constantly to find a place where what they can do and what the market needs intersects. So that's part of why, in my reporting, I follow people over long, long periods of time to capture the many reinventions that they might make as they try to find a way into the middle class. And the other thing that I think there's a tendency in writing about poor communities not to capture the full texture of life within families, particularly like the lives of women. I felt, before I came to write this book, that a lot of nonfiction about India, whether written by Indians or by people like myself who are not Indian. This is true both in nonfiction and film. There were a lot of bar girls. There were a lot of exotic dancers. There were a lot of prostitutes. And you would be forgiven if you were reading about a slum to think that every woman in the slum was in the sex trade in some ways. And I thought, where are the women? Where are the mothers? Where are the children? Where are the women earners in this economy? And what I found, of course, was that in a place like Anawadi, and this was also true in other slums, that there were many men who had been completely defeated by illness or by alcoholism, and women were the primary earners in those communities, and I just didn't feel that that had been captured.
It struck me just in the way you tell the story that the really hard workers are the kids, the teenagers, and the women.
Right.
And it's not the men at all, though a few of the men actually have jobs.
Right.
And so it's a completely different perspective. This is very much a matriarchal society.
Yeah, what's interesting is that if you take Abdul's mother, Saranisa, who is has raised 9 children, she's got a 2-year-old on her breast, and she was born in Pakistan, and her mother, everybody that she knew, practiced purdah. So here she is in Mumbai, cast into a life that she totally didn't expect because of the illness of her husband, and she's had to work in the market economy among scavengers and thieves. And even though her husband doesn't work, her husband is still incredibly condescending to her. And one day she says to him, just because you can read and I can't, you think you're the big Sharif. If I would have been stuck in my mother's womb if you hadn't come to get me out. So, yes, it's a matriarchal society, but still the women feel very much under the control of the men that they're with. Sometimes I think that that even makes them feel safer. It's as if they almost invent their husbands as people different than they are, because that makes them feel less vulnerable and alone.
Catherine Boo, 7 months into it, there was the death of Fatima. It suddenly gave you a hook to tell your story, because we had a real plot line going on mm-hmm. here. Had that ever concerned you, or had you never reached that point where you were going, how am I going to take this and turn it into a book?
You know, when you start a project like this, you have no idea. You have no idea whether it's going to be anything. You have no idea whether you're going to be able to overcome the obstacles to reporting it and really get into people's lives, and because I was an outsider, to really understand anything about them. I focus on this incident because it did bring this kid Abdul, who basically never left the slum except for to go to the recycling plant, it brought him and his family into the whole criminal justice system, and it brought Fatima into the public hospital system. So these stories became a way of illuminating some of the larger institutions. But it wasn't the only terrible thing that had happened at Anawadi, or the only dramatic thing that had happened at Anawadi. So it wasn't that this happened and I thought, oh my God, that's great, I have a story to tell. It was a tragedy. But had I not told this story, there were many other stories that I had to tell. And one of the things that I was trying to do as a writer was not just to write about the terrible things that happened at Anawadi or the tragic things that happened at Anawadi, but also to talk about the hope there and the sense of joy and the sense of family intimacy.
It seemed to me in reading Behind the Beautiful Forevers that every idea by the Indian government to make things better in a place like Anawadi turned out to make things worse.
Or just not to have an effect at all. But that was part of what I'm always interested in, America and in India, is that sometimes the most sensitive intellection that we have in Washington, in Delhi, put together by serious policymakers and people who actually do want to see opportunities better distributed among the poor, looks very different by the time it's experienced, you know, in the places where low-income people live, whether it's micro-lending or set-asides for low-caste people or minorities. It works very differently.
There were no Parsis there, were there?
No. They're very wealthy in general.
It's all lower caste, Hindus and Muslims.
Yeah, and a few Christians.
And most of them are immigrants from elsewhere.
And one of the reasons Anawadi is, and many slums are full of low caste or backward caste people, is because in rural India, some of the historic caste oppression is very much alive and well. And so people of low caste flee to the cities like Mumbai so that they can have an existence that is not determined by their caste. And in Anawadi, particularly among the young people, caste just wasn't important. People barely knew the caste of their friends. It just was the older people knew, and the older people had their judgments about each other. But among the young people, the really important thing was who here had economic prospects. There was this smart, undersized, intense kid named Prakash who had been raised middle class, and his father got hit by a train, so he was downwardly mobile, but he had a chance. He wanted to study business. He wanted to get a job in one of these office towers, and he had immense status in the slum because of his chance that he had to really join the culture of the overcity. Nobody knew his caste. They just knew that he had a shot at being middle class or even better.
You talk about Anawadi possibly being destroyed. I guess as of right now, it still exists.
Yes, the slum next to it has just gotten notice that it's going to be razed any day now, but they don't know when.
Is Asha still in the slum?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So nobody's left at this point?
No, everybody's still there. That's not true, because Sunil is now doing work at a tiny factory in another slum, and so he's sleeping in the workplace there just now. So he comes back to Anawadi all the time.
You want to be an observer, yet these are your friends now. Do you feel like you want to help them?
I practice not without ambivalence the ethics of my profession, which is that we don't pay people to tell their stories. We don't. And it's in part because of the idea in my profession that if you pay people, that distorts the stories that you get. I think that's true, but I think now that the book is over, I'm feeling the people who participated in this book did so without any expectation of any kind of financial gain. They participated in this book, as Kay Kishan put it, when I was at Anawadi giving out advanced copies of the book several weeks ago. She said, no, it's just important that people know about our lives and details and the hardships we face, that they can, you know, and it's not just us, it's so that they know what all of us are going through.
Well, what did Asha think of the book?
Well, Manju has read the book. Yeah, I've got an SMS message from her. I could show it to you.
What does she say?
She likes it. The way she read it is interesting because she read first, she's a teenager, she read all the parts about herself first, and then she read all the parts about her mother, and then now she's just gone back and read the rest of it.
Are people reading it aloud to one another?
Well, she's reading it in English. She's one of the few who can read it in English. There's another boy named Amol who I'm told is reading it. And so she's telling other people what's in it. But the way that the kind of reporting I practice, by the time Manju sees the chapter on her, we've already gone through fact-checking. Like, okay, do you remember that? Did I get the color of the sari right? If there's something she'll remember differently, and then we'll go and we'll look at the video or we'll listen to the audio or looking at the note. So to her, when she comes to this book, it's not, oh, my God, she wrote this, because we've gone through that fact-checking.
So they all know exactly what's in the book because someone has gone back to them and double-checked every little sentence,
right,
pretty much.
Right, yeah. there are some people who are dead. So, you know, so sometimes, for instance, with Fatima's husband who drank. I mean, so I did the best I could, but I'm not sure how much he knows. But for people like Zaranisa and Asha and Manju and Sunil, they're very much aware of the level of detail.
The corruption, police corruption, builder corruption, all kinds of corruption from government, when I read that, a part of me wonders, are we less corrupt here?
I think that there's marginally more accountability here, programs for the poor. Here's a very clear example. There's a moment that I describe in my book where a scavenger, a man who gathers trash, is lying on the road with a bloody leg, and he's asking for help. It's right where the rocky road from the slum hits the airport road, the beautiful airport road, and so he's, 300 yards from the Hyatt, and cars are going past to the airport, and he's lying on the road, and thousands and thousands and thousands of people pass by him, and nobody wants to run to the police station to ask for help for this person, because everybody's afraid that going into the police station, they will be falsely accused or, you know, asked to pay money. And so everybody just hopes that the next person is going to risk the police station to get help. And by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, this man who's been lying in the road since at least 6 a.m. is dead. And then people call the police station. Then somebody with political connection calls the police station to say, here's a corpse that's disturbing small children. Well, in the American inner city, if you are a victim of crime, you will typically call 911. If people will, you know, see somebody lying on the road, people will typically, not always, but typically, call 911. There's not the same sense, even though there are many, many problems in police forces in all across the country, there's not the same immediate presumption that the people you call in for help are going to hurt you.
And I would guess something similar is true. The hospital you describe is just horrific. It's not even a hospital.
Right, right. And that's one thing that I think that people who lived in Mumbai have pointed out to me. They said they didn't really know that about the public hospitals. But over the course of years of reporting, I never followed someone into the public hospital where they didn't have to pay, the free public hospital, where they didn't have to pay under the table money or go outside on the street and buy in drugs, bring their own food, because the hospital didn't supply it. And, you know, the drugs that were received by the public hospital were often resold, often to the people in the shops outside, so that people were making a little money. And one of the things that's interesting, and also using the documentary record, I looked at how the official records of what people were suffering from, their injuries, were often changed when they died so that the hospital couldn't possibly be held to account for the poor conditions at the hospital itself causing the deaths.
Thriti Umrigar, when I asked her, you know, what can India teach us, she said, well, you know, if you look at what the right wing in America is saying about, you know, removing government from everything and cutting taxes, she said, it teaches us what we should not become.
I think she says it beautifully. But I also think that if you only look at India as an object lesson in what we don't want to be, I think you miss also what is amazing about it. What's interesting to me is how much, despite the obstacles that people face, there's just an enormous amount of hope that people have, even in the most objective conditions, that they do have a shot at being part of the middle and upper classes that they see around them. And there's very little despair. There is weariness.
Do they have role models of people who have left places like Anawadi and moved up?
There was one man who got a government. So, I mean, just think about that statistic. 6 people in 3,000 have permanent work. And the ones who have, yeah, this is the way we work now. So the ones that have permanent jobs, most of them are still in the slums, but a few, and the permanent jobs may be things like cleaning toilets for the sanitation department. Doesn't matter. They are the rock stars. They're the people who have made it and have some kind of job security and some kind of social protections. And a few of those people with permanent work had moved on to other places. And, of course, when they left, nobody knew what became of them. But people were aware that it had happened. Some people couldn't remember a single person who'd moved out of the slum to somewhere better. But a few people would say, no, there was this guy once. And that fact radiated and inspired so many other people.
What still haunts you, Catherine Boo?
Many things. Sometimes people ask me, like, how come you don't write much? Like, you know, I'm not the most prolific writer. But part of it is that you, like, when you finish a project like this, you can't go straight on to another one. You know, you have to, in some ways, recover psychologically from these things. And one of the things that I've been thinking about so much is a woman named Kalpana, who's not in the book, but she's very much in my head. And Kalpana was one of many people in the slum who were dying of tuberculosis and completely ill-served by, despite considerable amounts of Indian government and foreign funding going into the care and treatment of contagious tuberculosis, there was, you know, on a practical level, there was just no help for people like her. And she had a choice in the last months of her life. She had three children, and she loved them deeply. And she knew she was dying because people were, had been just dropping like flies down the slum lane. And she had a choice. And her husband, ever since she got TB, had been keeping his distance. So she had these three children. She was essentially raising them alone. And she had a choice of loving them and holding them and making them feel valuable and special in the last years of her life, or risking that she would be transmitting her tuberculosis to them. And that choice, I just keep thinking about that choice.
With these other stories, I guess as you were still there, you were going through everything on a daily basis to try to keep up, because otherwise it's impossible.
Right.
There must be a tremendous amount of other material that never could have made it, and a lot of people who never could have made it.
Right, right. And part of what the reader doesn't see is what you left out. And if you think about Kalpana, this woman that I just talked about, I also had a choice as a reporter. I spent a lot of time with her. But I didn't feel that she should spend her last months on Earth answering my questions. So ultimately, I thought that I didn't want to divert from the enormous psychological work that she was doing in these last months of her life. And the reader doesn't see all the blind alleys that I went down, all the time that I spent reporting on things that don't end up in the book. For instance, you know, when I look back at my video footage, there were days spent on the set of a Bollywood movie, where one family in the slum had gotten a job hammering sets and painting. But they got that job, and then that job went away in 2 weeks, and then they didn't have any job. And so what I thought was you know, one, for, and what they thought was an avenue out of poverty didn't actually turn out to be that. And so there are many times like that. And one of the great things about the video footage is that you can review all the days and all the work that you did and all the interviews you did and all the people you got to know. You know, they're not part of the story, but they are part of what I understand about the place that helps me to write the stories that I write.
Well, you've said I'm not a utopian, but at the same time, ideas might have been generated about anything that could be done, not even to help them, but to find ways to make life more worth living.
Right. I mean, in every country, it's the same thing about people who are low income and often illiterate, and they don't have the same access to technology that middle class and upper class people have. It's very difficult for them to force their societies to be accountable for the things that they promised to them. So the question to me is not that it's the last mile problem, anti-poverty and opportunity issues, is how do you bring accountability to the programs that are supposed to serve low-income people. For me as a journalist, I can get the access to the records. Even when I get knocked around in a police station, I can put in a formal complaint. I can document it. I see that as a place where journalism can be useful. It's not that many, many people are doing this, and maybe there's some very cool people doing this kind of journalism around the country, around our country, and in India as well. But I think it's important until some of these so-called digital divides get breached and until more literacy is higher, that if we can document some of the ways in which good intentions get subverted, that maybe the people who have power might pay attention to that. There's no chance of change if people are allowed not to know what's going on in these communities. You know, I don't make great claims for the social effects of my journalism, but the only thing more hopeless is if you just don't do that work at all.
You know, I look to see what these five-star hotels cost per night.
Mm-hmm.
Only a little over $200 a night.
I mean, in off-season.
Well, I mean, I guess off-season
yeah.
Now. And I looked at that and I'm going, you know, that's expensive, $200 mm-hmm. a night, but it isn't a deal breaker.
Well, I just, you know, I haven't been to San Francisco before. This is my first time, and so I've just learned about the $5 coffee. Oh, my God, the $8 water?
Couple of quick questions. Speaking of water, water is not safe to drink there.
No.
And you, I'm sure, brought your bottled water. Did they ask you to bring bottled water for them?
Well, I drank the water there.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. I mean, because you just can't. not. You're hot. You're thirsty. There's water. You drink the water. And then afterwards you think, well, maybe I shouldn't have.
Were you okay?
Yeah, it wasn't so bad. No, I drank the water. I fell in the sewage lake. That was much worse.
They did know modern culture quite a bit.
Yeah.
I mean, they did do that. They went to the movies when they
right.
could. And I'm sure if they had a PS3, the kids would be playing them. Underneath it all, people are people.
Yeah, people are people. And the problem is that I've done work before that doesn't fully acknowledge, that doesn't fully draw out the similarities that we have between us. I think that a woman like Zaranisa, with the husband who's not contributing to the family and who's raising these kids with real delight and imagination, is a woman that I think mothers anywhere could relate to, you know, trying to balance their economic obligations and their, you know, their time for their children. And a woman like Asha, who's making hard choices and immense sacrifices to give her daughter a better life. They're not alien people. They're a lot more like us than we want to believe.
This other material you have, are you planning to do more writing for The New Yorker, short pieces on some of the other stuff you've learned?
No, but I think that everything I've learned, even if I don't write about it, ends up informing what I do in the future. And one of the things that I'm interested in doing now is there are aspects of the investigative work that I want to work with other journalists in India so that, you know, to bring out some of these issues.
Is that what you're planning for your next project then?
I'm planning to get through this strange period of talking about my book and then decide what to do next, because I knew whatever my next project was, you know, moving between the work that I do and this kind of stuff, there's too much cognitive dissonance. I'm getting through this and then I don't know where I'm going to go next.
You've been listening to an interview with Kathryn Boo, whose book is titled Behind the Beautiful Forevers, Life, Death, and Hope in a Mumbai Undercity. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.